On December 23, 1991, a small house in Corsicana, Texas, was destroyed by fire. Inside were three little girls, a two-year-old and 2 1-year-old twins. These were the daughters of Cameron Todd Willingham and his wife. She was out shopping when the fire happened. Willingham was seen running out of the house and had sustained smoke and burn marks on his arms. Witness reports about his demeanor were mixed. As smoke was billowing out of the house, he screamed at a neighbor to call 911 because my babies are in there. But he was also described as both hysterical and strangely calm as the fire was burning. The state of Texas charged Willingham with murder by arson. State investigators said that the fire had been deliberately set based on what they said was proof that some sort of liquid accelerant had been used. Willingham was convicted and sentenced to death. Years after Willingham's conviction, but before his execution, an expert reviewed what the state fire marshal had relied on in claiming that the burn patterns must have resulted from the use of an accelerant. This scientist conducting the review concluded that there was no evidence of arson. Nevertheless, the Texas Board of Pardons and Paroles turned down Willingham's clemency petition. Governor Rick Perry refused to grant a pardon. Willingham was executed. And some years later, another expert was hired, this time by the Texas State Fire Commission, another state agency. And this expert again said that there was no evidence of arson. He said that what the state investigators had relied on in putting together their case against Willingham was based on nothing more than myth. Our state has the death penalty, just like the state of Texas does. We are one of 32 states that has the death penalty. We have 9 men on death row at this point. In the last 4 decades, we have put to death 5 men. The state of Texas leads in this race to the bottom. They have put to death, I think, 510 people since the death penalty was reinstituted in the mid-70s. They have 292 people sitting on death row awaiting execution. And you won't be surprised if you saw the statistics about how many of those people were racial minorities. It's shocking, really. So I'm going to tell you another story about another execution. In 1974, when he was 20 years old, Charles Rodman Campbell sexually assaulted 23-year-old Renee Wickland. She was outside doing yard work in her little town of Clearview in Snohomish County. Campbell had threatened to kill Renee's infant daughter, Shauna, unless she didn't comply with his demands. 2 years later, after Renee Wickland picked him out of a police lineup, Campbell was arrested and charged with first-degree rape. Renee Wickland and her neighbor, Barbara Hendrickson, testified against Campbell at his trial. He was convicted and sentenced to serve 40 years. However, he was paroled after 5 years in 1981. One day in 1982, Barbara Hendrickson's husband walked over to Renee Wickland's house. There, he found the bodies of his wife, Barbara, Renee, and Renee's 9-year-old daughter, Shauna. Each had had their throats slit. Shauna had lost so much blood that the coroner had a difficult time collecting a blood sample. In addition to her throat being cut, Renee had also been beaten and sexually assaulted with a blunt instrument. Campbell had attempted to sell some of Renee's jewelry within hours of the killings. He was arrested and charged. Numerous citizens of the town of Clearview signed a petition demanding that Campbell be given the death penalty. Campbell was convicted. The jury found no reason to show leniency, and he was sentenced to death. 12 years of appeals and petitions, including a petition to the U.S. Supreme Court for a stay of execution that went unanswered, ended with Campbell's hanging on May 27, 1994. The governor at that time, Mike Lowry, spoke to Campbell in a meeting that lasted less than 30 minutes. Lowry said recently that even though he opposed the death penalty, he decided that after meeting with the families of the murder victims and after meeting with Campbell, that he would not exercise his power of clemency. I am a criminal defense attorney. I have represented individuals accused of almost every type of crime you can imagine, horrifying and mundane. I have represented people accused of murder. I have represented people accused of child molestation. I have represented people accused of rape. I have represented people accused of domestic violence, burglary, robbery, drunk driving, shoplifting. But I would never agree to represent a defendant accused of a capital crime. That is, a person facing the death penalty. The death penalty is legal in this country. For a while, from about 1972 to 1976, it was not. The U.S. Supreme Court, in the case of Furman versus Georgia, considered three cases. One of a man convicted of murder in Georgia, one of a man convicted of rape in Georgia, and one of a man convicted of murder in Texas. It did not go unnoticed by the justices that all three defendants were black. In 9 separate opinions, and by a vote of 5-4, the court held that the death penalty statutes in those states violated the Eighth Amendment's ban on cruel and unusual punishment. The justices held that the way death penalty statutes were written, juries were given unfettered discretion, that is, no limits and no guidance, in deciding whether to vote for death, which inevitably led to arbitrary application of that penalty. Although the Furman decision stopped short of finding any application of the death penalty to be unconstitutional, it did invalidate the death penalty in all states. All the states that had a death penalty statute on their books had to rewrite that law if they wanted to continue executing prisoners convicted of capital crimes. A capital crime, by the way, is what the government entity carrying out the execution says it is. In 5 states, including California, capital crimes include not only murder, but also treason against the state. In Washington state, a person is subject to the death penalty if they are convicted of what we call aggravated murder. Aggravated murder is murder in the first degree, which is typically an intentional killing, where the government also proves one or more aggravating factors. These aggravating factors are limited to those listed in the statute, although the list is pretty long and it gets longer all the time. Those reasons include killing a police officer, killing a judge or prosecutor or defense attorney, killing more than one person at a time, killing a news reporter, being the buyer or a seller in a contract killing, or killing someone while committing one of 5 other serious felonies, including robbery or arson. Who decides who gets the death penalty? In our state, it's the elected prosecuting attorney where the defendant committed the crime. The decision to seek the death penalty often as not varies based on which county the offense took place. Among counties in Washington with 5 or more aggravated murders since 1981, prosecutors sought the death penalty at a rate ranging of a high of 67% in Thurston County to a low of 0% in Okanagan and Yakima counties. In the decades since capital punishment was reinstated in Washington, 2 of the 5 men executed were from Snohomish County. 3 of the 9 men currently sitting on death row were prosecuted in Pierce County. Small counties can't afford to prosecute a death penalty case. Big counties with big budgets, like King County, might be able to absorb those costs, but big counties have big budgets because they have big needs. One could think of many worthwhile expenditures that could be fully funded in King County if they hadn't already spent $7 million prosecuting the 2 defendants charged in the Carnation Christmas Eve killings And those cases haven't even gone to trial yet. So one could start to suspect that it might matter less what the defendant did than where he did it. Opponents of capital punishment cite this as further evidence. I will never do this again. I don't care how much paper I save. Further evidence of the unconstitutionally arbitrary application of the death penalty. But can we ever completely rid the criminal justice system of arbitrariness? At almost every step of the investigation, the prosecution, the trial, and the appeal, the outcome, which is life or death for a defendant in a capital case, is driven by human decision. And humans are weak and fallible. Maybe the detective who led the investigation decided not to explore that piece of evidence that didn't fit his theory of the case. Maybe the elected prosecuting attorney put his thumb on the scale in favor of his reelection campaign when he decided to seek the death penalty. Maybe the defense attorney who was assigned to represent the accused decided it was probably just a waste of time to interview those rumored eyewitnesses. They wouldn't have helpful information anyway, right? Maybe the one potential juror who would have seen a reason to be lenient and refused to vote for death decided not to respond to the jury summons. Maybe the judge who presided over the trial had a bad morning that day that she had to make several pivotal decisions that affected whether or not evidence harmful to the defendant was going to come in. And maybe the defendant had the bad luck of having his case reviewed on appeal before our collective standards of decency had evolved enough to recognize that this defendant should not be put to death. This final phase, appellate review, is how people like Daryl Atkins and Donald Roper were ultimately spared the death penalty. The U.S. Supreme Court recognized that it would violate the Constitution to execute a mentally retarded person, like Mr. Atkins in a 2002 decision, or a person who was a juvenile when he committed his offense, like Mr. Roper in a 2005 decision. The court held that application of the death penalty in those cases violated the Eighth Amendment's prohibition of cruel and unusual punishment. As the court observed in both of those cases, the Eighth Amendment must draw its meaning from, quote, the evolving standards of decency that mark the progress of a maturing society. This was the phrase referred to by several justices in Furman versus Georgia when the court invalidated the death penalty statutes in 1972. Justice Brennan quoted it, then went on to make several observations that might strike a chord among those of us in the congregation today. The state, he wrote, even as it punishes, must treat its members with respect for their intrinsic worth as human beings. A punishment is cruel and unusual, therefore, if it does not comport with human dignity. He went on to note that, quote, the state does not respect human dignity when, without reason, it inflicts upon some people a severe punishment that it does not inflict upon others. He addressed the argument made by proponents of the death penalty, that punishment of death is necessary for the protection of society, that the death penalty is, quote, a concrete public expression of moral indignation that inculcates respect for the law and helps assure a more peaceful community. To this, Justice Brennan replied, the question, however, is not whether death serves these supposed purposes of punishment, but whether death serves them more effectively than imprisonment. It is certainly doubtful that the infliction of death by the state does, in fact, strengthen the community's moral code. If the deliberate extinguishment of human life has any effect at all, it more likely tends to lower our respect for life and brutalize our values. That, after all, is why we no longer carry out public executions. You may have heard the adage, hard cases make bad law, meaning when the facts of a case are especially egregious or chilling or shocking, a judge trying to decide how to right some wrong can come up with rulings that only lead to unfair treatment of people in cases that come after. Cases with hard facts also tend to ignite the passions of citizens and lawmakers who draft legislation that's meant to somehow keep humans from doing bad things to one another. We see this in the proliferation of three strikes and two strikes laws, and in the ever-expanding list of grounds for a prosecutor to seek the death penalty. Before I became a lawyer, I hadn't given much thought to my position on the death penalty. I was aware of the awful facts underlying the Campbell's case. Surely, I thought, if anybody deserved to be executed for his wicked deeds, Campbell did. But as I worked in the court system, I began to question my assumption that human beings, especially any human-designed and human-operated system like the criminal justice system, were fit to decide who deserved what. And I saw that so much of what fueled the process of determining just deserts was a base craving for revenge. Given that many persons prosecuted in death penalty cases had themselves acted in revenge, it seemed a sad irony that the state was now a tool of vengeance for outraged citizens and grieving family members. Hard cases may make bad law, but they do provide a fierce fire in which you can forge your own principles. I have made up my mind about the death penalty. I did so almost a decade before I ever attended a UU church service. When I look at our seven principles, I see several that echo the reasons why I think that the death penalty is always, in every case as applied to every person, wrong. Whether the government should be allowed to execute its worst offenders is a topic that incites a passionate response from most people. Death penalty opponents are able to eloquently express why it's wrong in every case, but people who support laws that allow for the imposition of the death penalty, even those folks who are dramatically outnumbered in UU churches, can also eloquently express their reasons for at least keeping the law on the books. Without being able to threaten a suspected murderer with execution, law enforcement has lost considerable leverage in getting valuable information from their suspect. He could tell them literally where the bodies are buried, or who else may have been his victim, or who else may have been involved. But without the death penalty hanging over his head, and a life sentence sure to be imposed anyway, what incentive does he have to cooperate? When there is no doubt whatsoever that the convicted person is actually guilty, why spend any money housing and feeding that monster for the rest of his wretched life? And doesn't the taking of a life after justice has been rendered even up the scales when the murderer has taken an innocent life? Doesn't that act serve to affirm the sanctity of human life? I believe that allowing the government to execute its citizens, even the worst of the worst, undermines our first principle, to affirm and promote the inherent worth and dignity of every person. That we sanction this after the defendant has been through the wringer of the criminal justice system, perhaps over a period of decades, just makes that final act of the state all the more cold-blooded. And having witnessed and studied countless court cases, I am sad to report that when it comes to how we treat criminal defendants, the values embodied in our second principle, justice, equity, and compassion in human relations, is more likely to happen by accident than by design. It is the unique nature of the death penalty, as summarized by Justice Stewart in Furman versus Georgia, that persuades me that that penalty should be permanently removed as an option. He said, "The penalty of death differs from all other forms of criminal punishment, not in degree, but in kind. It is unique in its total irrevocability. It is unique in its rejection of rehabilitation of the convict as a basic purpose of criminal justice. And it is unique, finally, in its absolute renunciation of all that is embodied in our concept of humanity." Hard cases make well-forged principles. My stance on the death penalty is clear and strong and happens to fit well with how I interpret our UU principles. But here is an issue where my footing is less sure. If my opposition to state-sanctioned executions is based on my belief in the inherent worth and dignity of every person, how do I reconcile that with my support of a woman's right to choose? I know, in my heart, I know that even the miserable human beings who face execution are still human beings. Each one is a person of inherent worth and dignity, no matter how small that measure might be. But do I know that an embryo, even one as small as the lump of cells that occupies the womb at 3 or 4 weeks, is not a person? Because I myself, in fact, have had 2 unwanted pregnancies that I did choose to terminate, it's safe to say that, semantically speaking anyway, I believe that each of those embryos was not a person. At least, not a person whose inherent worth and dignity was more valuable than my bodily integrity, my ability to control my future, and my very freedom. I terminated those pregnancies some 30 years ago, and I have no regrets over either of those decisions. It was years later, after I became intentionally pregnant with my son, that I realized how forcing a woman to carry to term an unwanted pregnancy is a repudiation of her inherent worth and dignity. Seeing how being pregnant really takes over a woman's body and can subject her to dangerous complications reaffirmed my position on a woman's right to choose. But this small doubt in my mind is why I can't really muster any outrage, or not much anyway, that a company run by fundamentalist Christians might be able to exclude abortion coverage in their employees' health care plan. I do believe that with very few restrictions, a woman has a fundamental right to decide whether to carry a pregnancy to term. But in recognizing the Christian person's, quote, free and responsible search for truth and meaning, and that is our fourth principle, I am reluctant to force that person to pay for a procedure that they believe is murder. I'm just waiting for socialized medicine to answer all of that. In exercising our fourth principle, as well as our fifth principle, the right of conscience and the use of the democratic process, we are called upon to make difficult decisions that require us to carefully weigh what we value. For me, a woman's fundamental right to control her destiny by controlling what happens to her body adds value to her life and preserves the dignity of all women. I see nothing of sufficient value that is added when the state executes a person for a crime that's already been committed. I began this talk with 2 stories of men who met the same irrevocable, though perhaps not deserved, fate. I'd like to conclude with 2 stories of men who followed their conscience to the end of another person's life. In the Washington State Penitentiary in August 2001, a 58-year-old church janitor named James Elledge was executed by lethal injection. He had been convicted of the murder of Eloise Fitzner in 1998. He had invited Eloise and her friend out for dinner, but that was a ruse. Instead, he lured them to the church basement where he worked. He bound each woman to a chair, covered the head of Eloise's friend, and turned her to face the wall. And then he strangled Eloise and stabbed her in the neck. His motive was revenge, because Eloise had previously bad-mouthed him to his girlfriend. And it wasn't the first time Elledge had killed someone. Elledge was caught and confessed immediately. But he refused to put on a defense. He was represented by an experienced public defender. But he would not let his attorney do his job. Elledge wanted to be found guilty, and he wanted to be put to death. He is what we call a volunteer. This presented an unsettling moral and professionally ethical dilemma for his attorney, a man who was adamantly opposed to the death penalty. His attorney believed that the death penalty did nothing for society. It was no deterrent, and it was disproportionate and unevenly administered. His attorney believed that, ultimately, quote, the death penalty makes killers of us all. But this attorney also believed that in a free society, every person has a right to choose and direct his own defense. Even though civil libertarians and other defense attorneys tried to halt Elledge's execution, his attorney fought them off. The night Elledge was put to death, his attorney spent 3 hours with him and stayed to witness the state perform the execution. His attorney felt it was a personal obligation to attend Elledge's execution. He explained beforehand that Elledge saw his execution as a redemption. In speaking to reporters, he said of Elledge, "As negative a thing as this is, it is still, in his mind, something he figures is an important part in putting together the story of his life." Years ago, I had a conversation with a defense attorney who was one of the appellate attorneys for Charles Campbell. I found out in talking with this attorney that he had attended his client's execution. Having only practiced myself for a couple of years at that point, I found that fact astounding and impressive. To watch another human being die, his death brought about at the end of an intentional process and in the prime of his life, surrounded by people who wanted him dead. A human being who was your client, someone you tried to save. This is why I will not represent someone accused of a capital crime. If you lose the case, they kill your client. I asked Campbell's attorney why he decided to attend the execution. I don't remember his exact words, but what stuck with me was that he felt compelled to do so because of his faith as a Quaker. He left it for me to figure out why that was important, but since becoming a Unitarian Universalist, I think I know why.